be blue, 'cause I can't see you.
Hello, and welcome to Vintage Gentle's Archive Outsider Podcast. This is your host, Richie, or Rich Wexler. I'm very excited about today. I get to talk to two really amazing people. One is Dave Gebro. I've gotten to know Dave through becoming involved with a Patreon for Disco Graffiti. Disco Graffiti is Dave and Joe Kennedy's podcast. I'm just going to kind of read over the bio because it does the best job. Heavily researched and always reassessing with fresh ears, the hosts of Disco Graffiti, Joe Kennedy and Dave Gebro, as well as the occasional guests, don't just cover albums. They do a deep dive inspection of all EPs, singles, compilations, relevant solo working and bootlegs, and notable appearances on other artists' record. Now, I want to just plug in here that this is the connection, is that Dave really, and Joe, I know Dave more, really are in the same world of what we're doing at Vintage Gentle's Archive in terms of just digging and finding the odd stuff, the weird stuff, honoring the people we speak with. We're very strange bedfellows, so to speak. Our other guest is Paul Major. The best way I can really explain Paul Major is by this amazing article written by Bijou Belenky in Huck Magazine called Psychedelia Supremo. Paul Major is the undisputed father of record collecting. Speaking to Paul Major, and this is Bijou, essentially speaking. Speaking to Paul Major is like flocking through a super chilled out encyclopedia of alternative music. When I call him to talk about a new book chronicling his life's work, it's midday back in New York. He's only just picked up his first cup of coffee and is getting ready to turn on the news and get what he calls his daily jolt of absurdity. If you're not into psychedelia or rare records, you might not have heard of Paul before. But the way we understand music today has his hands all over it. He is the original sound scavenger and vinyl collector, having spent the golden decade of rock music with his hands deep in the bargain bins of record stores all across the United States, looking for every odd sound that is yet to be shared with the world back in the 70s. Today, he is recognized as an expert in music made on the fringes of culture, from private pressings to one-song bands. When we start talking, Paul lists off names of obscure records and artists like nobody's business, telling me enough stories to make it clear that we're not just conducting an interview. This is a chance for me to hear firsthand about a part of history. I'm hoping we also add to that in this interview. Without Paul's work, I don't think you'd have a category called private press. I think other labels, I know like Numero Group labels are great, and I know like in the Attic is great, and I know they both put out this kind of stuff. And without Paul's work, I don't think that ever happens. So you're really on to something good. And again, please support Disco Graffiti podcast. They have a Patreon. I do the $20 one that gives me access to all the interviews that David and Paul do together, which is kind of the basis of this episode. And again, look up Paul, check him out. I mean, he's just amazing. And David's work, I'm just super impressed. I feel very lucky to be able to have this conversation. And one last thank you to Tony Larson. I've known Tony. Tony, I live in Philadelphia. Tony's a friend from West Philadelphia. Stand up, fucking another mensch, although Tony's not a Jew, but he is a mensch. Tony is a really great record collector. He knows a lot about private press music. And whenever I'm interviewing somebody who knows where I need to kind of have more knowledge, I don't have it, I bring in my ringer. So thank you, Tony, for being the ringer and for being part of the conversation. Enjoy.
Hey, there he is.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're good.
Paul?
Hey, here I am.
Paul is actually a self-professed Luddite, and
that's why he does what he does.
Exactly. If he was any other way, if he had a bank of computers in front of him, it'd be like, all right, interview over.
Because I have my own podcast, I don't even have time to listen to my own podcast. So I didn't really get to dig in too much into this one. I heard a few episodes, but I was blown away. It's really good. And you're very knowledgeable in this stuff. Whether, compared to Paul, none of us are. We're all children of the we're all his grandkids in private press world. But you're very knowledgeable about this stuff.
Well, listen, I mean, when I'm able to actually teach Paul about something, like, for example, if he's done a lot of work into an artist and then has turned his attention away. And you know, I'm thinking of the constant sound, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, so when I'm able to do that, I feel like a little kid who's gotten like a pat on the head from his parents.
And that can work because I am a person who's been off the map. Like if you ask me what went on in the last 30 or 40 years, I probably don't know. So it has been fun for me. These records, I couldn't find anything about them. And now they pop up like the Constant Sound or something. I found, oh, somebody found the story. And because I went off the internet and social media so much for the last years, I feel like, oh, you know, I'm doing a Rip Van Winkle and waking up and all of a sudden these mysteries are solved.
I'm not a big like money collector. I just can't afford it. But you just made me spend more money than I've ever spent on a record before because I had to track down the Kaplan Brothers. I had to buy the Kaplan Brothers album.
Have you heard it?
I heard it. And they said it was original. It's not. It's a reissue. But I don't have $400 or $1,000 to buy. I mean, that's not my.
You know, what'd you think? Who cares?
Oh my God, dude. I we'll talk about that in a second, but I wrote down.
It's so unique. I mean, even.
I wrote down if Sammy Davis Jr. and Tom Jones fucked, had a kid, and then somehow went to the future and singer, it would have been the Kaplan Brothers. Well, there's also, I also added Engelbert Humperdinck, but I thought three, you know. When I first listened, it sounded like Sammy Davis Jr. and Engelbert, but then I heard a lot of Tom Jones in there. And I love that kind of, I'm Jewish, I love that kind of shit.
Now, did you think I was being like a self-hating Jew?
No, I mean, we're all self-hating Jews, right? No. I mean, it's better to hate us, ourselves than other people, right? I mean, you don't, you know, it's fine. Paul, I've known your work longer, and I'm so nice to meet you. I'm like, I mean, Feel the Music and the Homemade, Enjoy the Experience, those records changed my life. And I mean, I've been obsessed with this stuff since hearing about you and all that stuff. And I mean, I have a Spotify mix that's 24 hours of private press shit that I've made over like 7 or 8 years and probably put about 60, 70 hours of research into based on like the world you opened me to. Another thing I'll just say for myself is, again, I love the outsider. I mean, between outsider art, outsider music, I mean, the whole theme of our thing is outsider. It's all people that didn't fit in. You know, I'm a photographer, so I do a lot of, you know, I think about, and I do documentary work. And the more I tell people, it's like photographers are the ultimate outsiders. We're literally outside of everybody else taking pictures. So that's where I'm coming from. Tony, can you give a little background on just like your world and, you know, how you're coming to the private press stuff or music in general?
I got into looking for records through hip hop, looking for old samples. And then that quickly branches out. You get thrown into the 70s. And then you start liking the music in the 70s, all the funk, all the jazz, all the soul. And then you start listening to more rock records. And then you start getting into psychedelic shit. And then you start noticing all the harder to find stuff is on weird homemade covers. And then you go into thrift stores and flea markets compulsively.
Yes.
And it's been 30 years of doing that. Wherever I go, I want to go to a flea market. You know, sure, I'm in India. I'll go see the Taj Mahal. That's an example. I haven't gone there. But, you know, I want to go to a flea market. So.
That's one of the interesting things to me, which sort of I couldn't figure out, like back, say, you're talking about in the time frame you're doing, where a bunch of these records that nobody ever wanted forever or something were sitting around. And all of a sudden I realized, wait, that one shot up to $100. And I'm thinking, what could it be? And it's a terrible record, but it had a beat, you know, that kind of thing.
Like the Dennis the Fox. Not that Dennis the Fox is terrible, but Rich passed my way the things that you guys wanted to talk about, and I saw Dennis the Fox. I'm like, oh, I know that. That's got a big, it's got a big ass beat on it.
It does. Yeah. You're talking about Pile Driver.
Pile
right?
Driver crosses over into our world. So,
in terms of most of my deeper knowledge of private press is probably through Numero. So, like, and I'm just gonna name some people that I kind of are into, just so you guys know where I'm coming from. Like, I get more into the folky kind of stuff. Eskew, Jim Sullivan, Robert Lester Folsom, D.R. Hooker, Jeff Cowell, Doug Ashbaum, Chuck Senrick, Circuit Rider, Daniel Johnson, Ted Lucas, Scott Fagans, Jim Spencer, West Coast Pop Art Experience Band, and Sheer Small. I want to ask you the first question for both of you is, I love that you say in the intro that the people that on the private press stuff are derailed by life's curveballs that the host can relate to. And not having the rock and roll lives they imagine. Tell me about why you chose that and how you guys connect to some of this music, if you're open to that.
Well, Paul, if you don't mind, because I wrote that intro. That's our second intro. Our first intro was kind of a placeholder for a few months. But then I woke up one day and I was like, holy shit, there's a reason why we're so in the throes about this thing. And, you know, I went to film school and I've made two films as a producer, director. And the third film I was trying to get off the ground over 15 years ago.
Is that Jesus 2?
Jesus 2 was, though, that was before my first.
Was that made real quick?
It was about half made.
Oh, man, I want to see that.
Yeah, so do I. So do I. funded with bar mitzvah money, which I think I mentioned in the Capital Brothers. But I kind of want to just talk about the road to the show and then leave it more in Paul's court, because Paul is, you know, I'm like you. I'm a fan, but I'm not like, you know, I think Paul is going to be listening to Private Press music no matter what. Yesterday, I just finished listening to U2's Songs of Surrender. So I'm all over the map. My favorite band in the world is the Beach Boys. They are not outsiders. So to me, it's all part of life's rich pageant, all part of the greatness of, I've heard every Dylan record, every Joni, every Bob, you know. So initially, this podcast started off just being discography trawls of bands. A couple months into the podcast for a Chronica present, because I'm going to hell, I married a Shiksa. My wife got me Feel the Music, The Psychedelic Worlds of Paul Major. It promptly changed my life. I mean, I was suffering from insomnia at the time. I still am. And I'd be waking up at like 1-2 in the morning listening to the Concrete Rubber Band and, you know, Frederick Michael St. Jude, I'm butchering his name, I think. All these people, all of a sudden, it went from this sort of vague knowledge of, like, almost like a William Hung thing, where people were pointing and laughing at these people who couldn't quite sing in tune. I grew a new set of ears. Like Paul says in his book, it fucking happened to me. And so I just wanted to scream from the rooftops. But Paul has been... you know, running from his, he'll tell you about this more probably, but he's been, you know, kind of running from the specter of his success in Endless Boogie, or that's, I think, part of, you know, what had made it difficult for me to get in touch with him. He's like, you know, fuck this Frankenstein I created. I'm out of here. So I'm like desperately tracking him down. Like, is there anyone who knows how to get in touch with this guy? I finally get in touch with him, and before we even do one episode, I start getting this idea about, hey, we could turn this into a TV show, because, you know, mainly I'm thinking there is nobody on this planet, regardless if you're a psycho music fan like us, or you don't give a shit about anything that's not on the charts, nobody can't relate to things not going as planned. And all of these people experience that in a major, major way that you know, gave them a curveball to deal with in their lives. And I totally relate to that. I relate to it on a musical level and on a very much on a personal level. And then speaking with them, it's so cathartic for them. It's cathartic for me, but it's, you know, to see the palpable impact. Go ahead.
It's a quick two-part question. So this is for both of you guys. So what I want to know is, what really connected you guys to do this together? Paul, and you can answer this too. What made you go from just being a super, you know, collecting all this stuff to really wanting to know about these people? I mean, I got the impression you've interviewed a lot of these people over the years. What made you cross over and like, I have to know this person. I got to hear their story.
Mixed motives. I certainly had to know this story because I would hear some records like Peter Gretzian and just figure this person has to be walking out of the Twilight Zone musically into the world. He's got to be that way. Or Kenneth Higney, which was the opposite. I thought, what's this guy like, looking at the cover and hearing it and find out it was the opposite of Peter Gretzian? He was the most normal, nicest guy in the world. And Peter Gretzian, I could go on for hours with anecdotes that are almost unbelievable about him. But my motivations were, I looked at these records and I felt like I was getting in obscurely into somebody's mind, unfiltered by, even if they had ambitions, unfiltered by any other knowledge, like they were isolated. I'm getting a real chunk of organic distance here and unusual lives. And my mixed motive too, when I first started tracking people down, was when I first started dealing records. So of course, I'm hoping to score copies. And, you know, I got much pleasure from calling somebody up and saying, hey, you know, you made this great record. I think it's incredible. And after I convinced them I wasn't one of their friends playing a practical joke on them, that I really liked the record, that they had maybe 100 people that heard it, and maybe 10 of those that actually would say, oh, that's good, and probably not even mean it, because it was something brilliant that went sideways, which is sort of, you know, my main angle. I love when things go sideways, when somebody tries something and the reasons that they think it went wrong are the reasons why, to me, why it becomes, you know, artistically valuable. So it was totally a mixed motive thing for that. And as soon as I started doing that and convinced people, and as soon as I said, oh, you know, you got a box of those in the attic somewhere, I'll give you $100 a copy. Figured back in the day, I figured I'd split 50-50 what I thought I could get for it in the market with the artists. And that, you know, they wouldn't believe me, you know, or something. Yeah. At first, you know, I'd say, no, you know, you got the box, I'll send you the money. And I would do that. And it was kind of generous, but back in those days, so little was known and unknown, and there was no internet, et cetera. It was like this secret knowledge. So I could sort of set the value, and I would judge it. If I got 50 copies, I'd think, how many people are out there? What's the right price I can maintain? And so that everybody gets it for the same price. And then I'd stash a few aside and just hold on to them. And later I'd feel like, okay, I created this like thing out of this record, and now it's like worth five times as much. It's cool, you know, that'll be my gravy for that situation. But it was really the number one passion. Just, I was so mind fucked by music and people that I had to share it.
That's really cool. I love how you came to the term real people music. I've always called it folk music, but when I say that, I'm like, it's music of the people.
Now with the internet and the access to information and so many people looking for records, and the fact that if there was a private press looking record, it's not going to sit in a thrift store for more than a day if it even ends up there. But, you know, also with so much information out there that we can all share, like, do you miss the days of the void of information and the, you know, letters and catalogs and the, you know, pluses and minuses to both, I guess. But
oh no, I miss it big time, because I felt like I was going out on some crazy safari. And I knew any giant used record store back before anybody knew about these things, I knew I had the eye to spot. I would buy everything that looked interesting, because everything that was really interesting was in their junk sections of those stores. And that would be all the local records. They'd be like, you know, Mothers of Invention record or something on the wall for $30. And then there'd be like what is now $2,000 psychedelic record in the junk pile, usually with coverware, because it's been sitting there for years. And I miss that feeling when I would go into a place that had a lot of records, whether it was somebody at a flea market or just anywhere, and walk in there and start looking. And then I'd see something incredible. And I think, ooh, I'm the first person with these kind of ears. I'm like, it's like, boy, this is one treasure chest. And it, until the internet really got going, it never ended. You know, certain obvious things that become famous, people got more hip too. And, you know, eventually it became, I wonder if there are any record stashes anywhere where somebody hasn't run it on the computer now, you know, and it's all gone. Because later, and the same thing with people sending me boxes of records from all over the world, I say, just send all the private records from your area and I'll figure out what they're worth, and I'll tell you which ones are crap and throw them away and which ones are great. And those days are all gone. Everybody, you know, overprices them now.
One great thing about the world being as connected as it is now is that Paul is able to experience a part of his life. Correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, but I don't think you had that sense of It's a Wonderful Life, of your impact on these people, to the extent that you've had an impact on all these people and exhuming their work and shining a light on it, well-deserved, until you know, this really kind of came to pass where, you know, you were able to find that out by being as connected as we are.
I want to make a point here because I listened to both parts of the Stonewall episode, and I want to say, like, this stuff is hard. I've had some concerns and been accused sometimes of exploiting people because it might seem weird. And my whole thing is, like, I can't control how you see something. If I present something with love and I like it, I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to get shit about it because it's not my intention. What I love about it is, I forget the guy's name, the drummer.
Tony.
You were so kind to him. You were respectful. He was so, you could tell how touched he was that you guys tracked him down and did that. And I think that's, you know, like, it's a mitzvah. It's a Jewish word for just a good deed. You know, mensches. You're both mensches. Mensches are a good old Yiddish word for a good guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, with that kind of thing, I can totally see why somebody would think that's exploitative. And perhaps it would be if we did not like the record.
Right.
And we were telling them, you know, you're obscure for a purpose, for a reason. But I don't even know if we would go ahead and track the artist down if we didn't like it.
Have you ever been accused by other people of just like, of, you know, or Paul, have you been accused of like championing the stuff as a joke? Not that, you know what I mean?
I was very aware of that syndrome early on, and it sort of crystallized even more when there was those incredibly strange music books, volume 1 and 2 came out. I was just seeing so much as this, like, something to point your finger at and snicker over and stuff. And from the beginning, that kind of stuff, oh, that's an interesting artifact, some of these trends and stuff there. But I was super conscious of being honest and not laughing at the artist or whatever, and realizing some people are going to take it that way. And, you know, sometimes it was difficult to track somebody down and explain to them, you know, some of the things that you thought went wrong or actually what went right in the big picture. But there have been, you know, artists where I have to say, oh, you know, yeah, you know, the fact that you're singing a little out of key makes it so much better because it's so much more you in your head and you're communing to people so much more directly, you know, and if they were the case of the people that actually, a lot of these private priest people, they had the dreams, you know, they just, and you know, they made the record, made me for themselves, but they had ambitions and they ran against a wall as soon as they got it out. Then it was like, oh, now what do I do with it? You know, before there was any, you know, I gave my mom a copy. I gave all my friends a copy. I got a gig and, you know, I sold a few at a show, but there was just, and back in those days, I had no idea before really the internet got going that this whole thing of these incredible records would be more than maybe a few thousand people worldwide ever into it. I never foresaw the day that, like when I had talked to Steve Morgan, I think some years ago or something, you know, saying, hey, you know, Have you looked at YouTube? You know, over a million people have listened to your song, and it's just really was sort of a thing where I was very conscious of saying I really love this stuff and that, and I was kind of aware and annoyed by people. I won't name names, but people that jumped on that strange music bandwagon. Just to me, it's like they're not responding to art. They're just gratifying their own superiority by laughing at something, you know, it's just, which I thought was kind of sick.
What I want to ask you guys about, too, is categories. So, like, for me, it's always been tricky. And because of your experience with psychedelic, I feel like there's, like, private press. There's something in your world that's a little more like psychedelic private press. And there's, like, outsider music. And they're so, you know, I don't know. It's hard. I feel like it's really tricky to even, if there is a difference. How do you see, what do you guys think, both of you, of those categories?
I think the boundaries of those categories are very porous. They leak into each other. Certainly, I sort of put it that way. And the categories almost to me are, when I use one, it's just sort of like to throw a little note out there, but not say, don't judge this because I'm saying it's this. It's just, you know, just some way to like steer things to the right people, like, which I had a lot of work with because I was trying to, when my record catalogs that book came out, it's like most of the people in those catalogs never heard of, you know, even collectors never heard of almost everything in there. So it became a, you know, a real thing where the categories were just kind of a, you know, a necessity to me to talk about it that way. But I can't, you know, put a border between is this outsider or not. It's like, right, you know, it sort of lurks there. With the real people behind it, I came to start hearing even all the famous artist records in that through that lens myself. I heard the Beatles very differently after I heard Kenneth Higney.
Right.
That being said, I think there's steps that one takes. And I think that the psychedelic stuff in the context of private press is safe, especially because you're probably not going to reach the private press world without going through some sort of psychedelic stream to get there.
Right.
But then real people, there's no corollary. There's no corollary. So that's kind of the end game, is real people. And I love it all, but Paul is more, if you had to be simplify it, Paul is more the real people guy. I'm more of a psychedelic fatso.
And Tony, what in terms of this kind of stuff, psychedelic or regular, what are some of your favorites in this world?
I mean, the favorites changes day to day, so it's too many. But I mean, I picked up one a couple months ago that I thought of coming over here, that I thought of you guys in the book. I don't know if it was in the book, Enjoy the Experience, that I've definitely leafed through, but I found this record called Robbie Martell at a flea market, and I didn't know it. You know, but the font was real cool on the cover, and the guy was looking happy and with a frilly lounge suit and looked like a lounge record. And then he does a crazy, like out of nowhere, there's one song with just crazy distorted fuzz on it. And he's doing Never on Sun. No, I forget what standard he is doing, but it's just out of nowhere. Some crazy song. Robbie Martell.
Oh, you know that guy?
It's not ringing a bell from the name. If I saw the cover or something, I might recommend
it. I wouldn't even call it
in the book. I probably would, but
It came to mind. You know, it was just, it's not a favorite, but it was just some weird thing that. And also, I wanted to comment on, you know, anyone. There's no one that knows everything, because this is such a limitless genre is limitless world of recorded music that, you know, we talk to Paul and of course he's brought so much of this to light. Then if we talk to Dave, he'll be bringing things to light that Paul might not know. And if you started talking, we'd be like, oh my God, Rich, what's that? I got to look into that. And none of the three of us would know it. So
you brought up somebody that was called Shira Small.
Oh yeah. Yes. That's pretty local to Philly.
I remember that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that fucking album.
And there was another record that was from a school. It was the George School, which was a Quaker school in Pennsylvania that had a band showcase, and Shira Small was on that record. But then from what I've read, like her, you know, because a lot has been written about her, but her, one of her teachers was like, yeah, you should do this as your senior project. Just make a record. You know, you're good at this. You know, she's a black woman from Harlem, I think, at a Quaker school, which was probably not very diverse, you know, probably a fish out of water. So I love stuff like that, you know, and that has this quirky, I don't know how that kind of weaved its way into my generation of hip hop heads who got exposed to a wider palette of music. There've been websites like, you know, forums like Soulstrut and Waxidermy that have brought a lot of this to our ears, but Shira Small just has this, it doesn't have a big, strong rhythm section, but it just has this feel, this very real person feel that.
Now, I remember when I first found that record too, and this is one of the elements is the actual physical look of the object really sets me up for intrigue and wanting to hear what it sounds like. And I remember the look of that record, the cover was very unusual. It could have been psychedelic, you know, the music within from the look of it, you know, until I heard it and liked it. So,
are there any, I don't know, stories of albums you found that were just, there's a difference in the cover to the album, or one you're just like, this looks awesome and it was. I'm just curious on you guys speaking about for a few minutes, connecting covers to, when I say covers, I mean, you know, to the actual album themselves.
I remember like specific records, and not just private press, but I remember as a little kid buying Bitches Brew because of the cover. I remember buying Blows Against the Empire because of the cover. And usually the interest in a record is the disparity between the greatness or shittiness of the cover and the music inside. It's usually not a match. It's usually how big or small of a disparity is there.
I've hit all three, I guess, of those. Once it's it's a forest for the trees now to single out names, but many, many that turned out to be just uninteresting. It looked like it could be a loner folk, dark guy like Perry Leopold or something like that. And then I heard it and it's just like, oh, okay, this is like Milquetoast James Taylor on kind of boredom scale that goes off the scale boredom wise. And there have been ones that had incredible covers, and sometimes even the case of the ones that never even had a cover, the ones where it's was just a plain cover with some scrawling on it, and you pull the record out and see the titles, and it has good titles on the label and the artist's name and no more information. And which way is this going to go? It has a song with a weird title, like, you know, Space Fungus or something. And the rest of the songs are, I love you, darling, so much, or whatever. And that's, I've had it go both ways. And I've certainly had ones that have matched up. Like the first time I, out in the wilds in the early 80s, saw Fraction, I knew there was no way that was not going to be good, looking at that cover.
And Josephus. Josephus is right on the money. You know what you're getting. You know how good it's going to be. There's no doubt of either of those things when you look at it. And Paul, it's got your typeface. Why don't you talk about that typeface?
You have a typeface?
Well, the lettering on Josephus is one that Josephus Dead made. It's there's something about, I was starting early on when I was buying every private press when I first really had my flash in 1977, I guess, because of Higney. I started noticing, somehow this typeface is turning up on the more interesting records. What does that mean? These people are choosing it out of the catalog, and the people that actually are musically more interesting to me seem to have some kind of thing for that typeface.
on the subject of fonts and type, I guess typefaces, sometimes I feel like the cover doesn't match the font. It's just like a polka record, but the font just looks good. You know, the font looks a little psychedelic, a little bent.
Yeah. I've had that with the font. I remember having a polka album with like UFOs on the cover. And I'm thinking, I hope this is polka gone wrong, but it wasn't.
Right. Polkas are tough. They rarely come through, but the fonts sometimes make me still buy them. These days, you got to take a chance on almost everything.
Where's that accent from? I'm trying to place your accent.
My mom's Italian, but it's mixed with Philadelphian lazy talk.
So. It's a little bit of jive. Do you know Edan?
Yes.
I just did a Patreon show on Beauty and the Beat, which I think is one of the great underground hip hop records.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely wanted to bring you down up because I feel like I know that Paul has played records out with Edan and done some things with him.
I didn't know that, Paul.
Yeah, we've done DJ things together, etc. Yeah. And yeah, he's my favorite dude, or the person in recent years, since I disappeared so much into the band and all these things and don't use the internet and all that. He's my favorite person to be around because he, at this point, turns me on to more things than anybody else. He has an endless pile in every direction, too. I have some limitations. Like, I don't know how to go, you know, deep into some genres like Boogaloo and things like that. And he'll pull up the stuff that is a mind warper that way or something. So
he maybe point the way for skiffle for me, because I don't know where the fuck to start with skiffle.
I don't know either. I'm sure there's got to be a weird one out there, but yeah, that's something I don't know.
He's like the Kevin Shields of hip hop.
I don't even know who Kevin Shields is.
From My Bloody Valentine. So he has Beauty and the Beat is this it's absolutely bulletproof. Yeah. It's like a perfect record. It's a concept album with a whole narrative to it. I didn't even know that until recently. But this is what I mean about, you know, you could do a deep dive and wind up just, you know, spinning out just on one record.
Right. What interests me about Edan in the context of talking with you guys is that he seems to be a little bit of the bridge between, I mean, he's very grounded in the hip hop generation of, he started that search and went into music and just it got really broad, but he's into psychedelic music now and into definitely into outsider stuff from all over the world and grimy garage and boogaloo. Like he's just completely expansive, but then he's got this foundation of amazing skill and talent that he you know, he makes these packages of beautiful things to for people to hear. It's been years now that he's been doing it.
Ah, absolutely. Yeah.
I love that he does this collaboration with you, because it's there's always been this kind of disconnect. You know, in the 90s when I was buying records at shows from dealers, you know, and formed relationships with the older guys, more of your age, they're saying, I can't really figure out what you're buying. You're buying a kid's record, you're buying psychedelic records, you're always buying funk records, you know, and you can't really, couldn't really explain to them. But where Edon's fit in is kind of like the bridge between the two generations a little bit. So
I want to ask all you guys a question about, while we're on the topic, on what are some of the your favorite sample use of this stuff as samples in songs?
I'm just going to jump in here and say that, you know, one of the great, regenerative prospects of this whole mission is recently, I haven't even told Paul this, recently one of the Patreon members did a mashup. He is a sampler, and he did a mashup of Michael Frenetti and Johnny Lunch Break, which was another Patreon episode I had done a few months ago. And the Birds from Wasn't Born to Follow. And I was just like, it was just a compendium of, you know, recent deep dive trawls. And that's what this is about carrying this message forward and having new ears on it. As far as specific people, I don't know, Paul, you might have, more of a handle on that.
Yeah, I don't know, because I'm so backdated in what I've heard. I don't know which ones are used that much, unless it's like a Dennis the Fox. I come across somebody in a conversation, and I got to now when I hear something, I think, oh, you know, that sounds like something that would be. But I'm so not knowledgeable about stuff much past the mid '80s. It's ridiculous, you know. So
have you, Paul, heard Edon's Beauty and the Beat that Dave mentioned?
Yeah, it was fantastic and crazy. Yeah. And this other thing he's done now, music, sound with pictures or something. Mm-hmm. He's done working with some guy, I think named Tom or something, using some of the stuff. And he does videos to these things. And a few of the things he selected for there are things I turned him on to. But yeah, that we listened to that out on the porch sometime. It was during COVID because Edon wouldn't come in the house. He played it out on the porch. We had a little listening session. So it was, you know, I can't imagine to have the patience to craft something technologically like that, that is that, you know, complicated or something. It boggles my mind. Just like when I saw him perform once and he's doing the turntable, he's doing a thing. He's doing like, well, it sounded to me like 100 words a second, like he's saying a whole book here and doing all this at once. I can't fathom how somebody could do that and not stumble over one word, you know, and all of its pluses bringing in science and all kind of these crazy ideas, too. It's not just like, you know, ranting off on something. It's like, whoa, this has message.
He's flawless. He's flawless. Like I try to. Sometimes when his name comes up with people who are into music, they're like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of into him. Like, his lyrics sound great. I'm like, yo, it's not even just carefully chosen words. Like, the syllables. Like, get down to the syllables. Every syllable is perfect. You know, it's, I admire the man's craft, but I also love the deep, deep, deep dive into the open-minded ocean of music that you guys are into as well. So,
okay, and myself too. I really, for me in my life, central is the real people thing, the person behind the record and all that. But I love all kinds of music, of course, you know, too. And things back in the day, I won't even try to dredge up which ones, but back in the day when I was doing my catalog and I'd be talking to people calling from Europe and all over the world and stuff, and I'd have something on, you know, popular. And people would get upset that I was listening to something.
Donny Osmond? All right. Paul, are there any guilty pleasures? You know, are there any Donny Osmond songs or something that people are like, really, really?
Oh, let's see. Guilty, you know, I absolutely, to this day, you know, if I hear something like, under the right circumstances, in the right frame of mind, something like one of the early Petula Clark U.S. hits, like Downtown or something, I feel like I'm getting as much joy out of this as anything else or something. So I have a real thing for pop songs. And the way I grew up on Top 40 radio, when I first started listening to music at the very end of 1966, the only way to hear stuff was on Top 40 music radio. So it'd be like you would hear the Music Machine talk right next to, you know, Frank Sinatra, Strangers in the Night, right next to Engelbert Humperdinck, next to Jimi Hendrix and that. And at the first time I had it, you know, it was like all these are kind of intriguing. So it wasn't like I was raised in a situation where you're formed, like you identify from your teenage years as a metalhead or whatever or something. It was like I just loved everything. And so Guilty Pleasures, you know, I love the first two Kate and Anna McGarrigle albums. I can't get enough of them.
I want to get into David a little bit and kind of, I want to draw a line from how you got into Disco Graffiti. I want to promote Disco Graffiti. So I want you to give me a little background on how that happened. And then, you know, and then I want to go into those episodes we talked about, the four episodes of OK. And, you know, and then we can kind of move around from there. But I really want to make sure I promote the overall podcast and the private press. So, Dave, I know your background is more, I know you did, you're a producer. One of my favorite albums over the years actually was Jessica Pratt, which you apparently managed. Were you managing a lot of other? I didn't know who LaSera was, but I know you managed them. Were you managing for a while?
I've stepped in all kinds of puddles of shit in my life. that was just one of them. I was friends with Ariel Pink, and as a result of that, I put on a show that was modeled after Altamont, like a non-murder version of Altamont.
No way that could go bad.
It went off really, really, it went like one of the best shows he ever had.
Oh, very cool.
I became his manager for about a year. And in that time, Jessica Pratt, La Sera, The Blow, I almost managed. but yeah, I mean, I'm not really a manager. It was just born out of the same passion that I used for the show. But around the time of when the pandemic happened, my original co-host, and I, his name's Joe Kennedy.
Right. And
he and I decided we were going to do this thing kind of on a lark. I think that's how a lot of times these kinds of things start, where there's a thing requires so much work, but you're completely ignorant of it and you think it's just going to be a blast. So you go ahead and do it. And then unfortunately too late, you realize this is going to be more work than it is going to be fun, but I'm too fucking far into it to stop. So that was the podcast. And so my Joe got off the train a long time ago.
Okay.
And I decided I got to do this because in a very quick amount of time, I had cancer and two neck surgeries. And so came face to face with my own mortality and realized my life is a veil of illusion. And it's time to start, you know, pandering to, you know, give the people inside me what they want. But then as I started getting into the show and then I found Paul, I realized that the end result of this thing was probably going to be a Patreon where we would get like the most obsessed music people in the world to kind of come behind us and at least fund the effort to where we could, you know, just make a go of it,
yeah.
have our bills paid every month, and then make a television show where we go into these people's houses, we infiltrate their lives, and we try to make some sense of the difference between the self-styled psychedelic guru that they saw themselves as 55 years ago versus the guy who's sitting in front of us with the world's greatest grandpa mug who just retired from his job as an accountant.
Do you see this as kind of creating an archive?
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know about you, Paul, but for me, I'm trying to, I think, understand my own relationship with failure or things going wrong or acceptance over things like that. You know, when we talked with Michael Farinetti, the music was just one part of a very fulfilling, incredible life. He moved on. It didn't work out. He moved the fuck on. Big deal. Then there's other people who basically immolated themselves because it was probably a seed that they planted, you know, when they were born. Is that if I go for my dreams and they don't work out, I'm going to fucking kill myself if I, you know, no matter what, nothing will stand in my way. Maybe it wasn't verbalized, right, but that script was probably within them.
But it's funny because you guys, in a way, you get to tell these people that the dream they had 30 years ago came true. It just took a fucking long time.
That's exactly it. And that is the best thing way back when, tracking people down who had just, some of them say, I haven't even thought of that for years or whatever. And some of them were bitter over it. They, you know, felt like, you know, I'm a failure and so forth. So the full circle thing of coming at, you know, their youthful idealism and dreams and ambitions, what they want to create, what they feel to have offered the world. 40 years, they think it's all lost, you know, it's, or whatever. And then I'm the person that says, you know, 100,000 people know about your record and they can't believe it. So I think it is the most fulfilling thing for me, that moment when somebody realizes this thing I did was not lost to time. It actually is in the archive now of people that are interested in this style of music. Yeah.
Do you guys know the Note Killer, the band Note Killers?
The name rings a bell, but I don't know.
Anyway, I don't even know, but it's my cousin's band, and same exact thing. He made this album in 78. It was like essentially psychedelic punk very early on, like, you know. And apparently there was an article in Spin that Thurston Moore did listing these like 10 albums that changed his life, and in one of them was my cousin. And then Thurston Moore wound up booking him for All Tomorrow's Parties. He put it in his album. And I mean, he didn't change his life drastically, but, you know, he got to live his dream when he was 65.
But it's also, it's confirmation that you weren't wasting your fucking time looking
right
at
it. Right.
You know, I mean, that's what it comes down to, because, you know, I think we're, you know, giving it more, you know, more due than maybe it's worth. You know, it's not like all of a sudden their dreams have come true, that all of a sudden they have the audience that they always thought they would. It's just that they know that if it hit this guy, it probably hit a few other people. So I can maybe go to sleep and actually stay asleep through the night now.
The contexts are so variable or something. Yeah, it's kind of hard to, I can't like pigeonhole or put everything into something, because as soon as I sort of think that, something will come along that just defies my thinking about it. So I almost feel like I have to take every single thing in context, everyone, almost like avoid trying shit that way, and realize, oh, you know, some, just like the thing where it's a record and the person only made it for himself, or like Higney, he made the record just to demo his songs. Had no thinking nobody's ever going to listen to this or something like that. Those type of people, as opposed to other people I tracked down, that at the time they were absolutely seeking commercial success too, or something. Right. And they both can work. Every context is different for me. Yeah.
What are a few things for both you guys that you're very proud of in doing this project?
The overriding thing for me is the connection with Paul. My life has become very solipsistic in that, you know, to post 3 shows a week, I'm working all the time. So I feel a kinship with Paul. We're not, it's funny, we're very different people, but we're also, on the inside, we're very much the same. But the way that we either, you know, try to overcompensate or, you know, decompensate for those things could not be any more antithetical. Isn't that right, Paul?
Well, yeah. Just to generalize, it's like you run towards stuff and I run away.
That's right. Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, Paul, you know, even though he looks like a wild man, and if you don't know who Paul is, you look at a picture and there's something terrifying about him to some people. There actually is. But they don't know. He's like the biggest sweetheart that ever walked the planet.
I get that. We get that a bunch on Endless Boogie Tours or something. When these people had this conception of me as being some wild-ass dude who maybe so badass he even got kicked out of the Hells Angels or something. And, and then I'll call to him and go, we do not understand. Why are you so nice?
But as far as a thing that we've done, for me, it's Farnetti, because the Michael Farnetti episode was supposed to be, you know, hopefully the idea was, let's see if the proof of concept of this thing being a TV show works as a podcast first before we do the TV show. And it's exactly what I was hoping for. and the way that it came out, the way that even people were responding to it in real time. Because when an episode airs, I'm getting texts from people who are listening to it. And so at the beginning of the show, I would get texts like, I don't understand why you went ahead and made a show like this. And then by the end, they're retexting me, holy shit.
Let's get into those episodes we talk about. But I want to ask you, and this, I don't mean this to be insulting, but I did not know what the fuck he was talking about. I wanted to. I really liked him. I really loved him talking. He sounded to me a little bit like Owen Wilson. I don't know why, but his voice. And I loved hearing him talking. He sounded totally sane. But what was he making sense to you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, here's all the context. Here's all the context you need. Number one, not everyone's going to connect with his record, which is called...
No, the music I love. I'm just talking about what he said in the thing.
So I think part of the way to understand that particular interview and a lot of the interviews that will be coming down the pike through this series is that Michael, this was his second ever interview. He's got decades of stuff that is probably barely making sense to him because he's just been sitting on it.
I got you. So
the way that it's coming out, it could be like just, you know, like you almost have to sift through it and find the truth. That's how I saw it. But also at the end of it, this, you know, profoundly, you know, deep experience that I had listening to the record, it turned out that a lot of it was just a guy who was looking to get laid. Well, there's an unedited, there's a Patreon show that is an unedited response, a single response to one question. That was his response was 15 minutes long. It took in the Civil War.
That's the one I listened to. That's the one I was asking about.
Okay. Then the answer to that is no. I have no idea what the hell he's talking about.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Me too. I figured, you know,
I feel bad because if you listen to it, if you're not paying attention, his presentation, it seems like he's prepared for a lecture. He's confident, but it's just he was talking about I got lost, but I loved hearing it.
Yeah,
I did too. I had this feeling. Okay, I know where this is supposed to go. It's starting to seem like it's never going to get there, and. You know, we're going to get up to what's going on in the world in 2023. And somehow he's going to be talking about he knows what's happening like 10 years from now or something. It just was kind of, it was baffling to me, too. I was just like, why is all this Civil War and everything? How is this relevant to this song he's talking about? And why? So that's part of the, you know, real people thing that I pull off too. You know, I just love to get somebody's head, and I don't always understand how the gears are turning. Right. I really like to watch them.
my three favorite categories of private press are what I call sad sack 70s guys, people that are just insane, and people that are religious, or religious and insane is a double whammy. I feel like that's a lot of these world. You get that. Like, I feel like in a lot of it's out there. It's like those three categories are my favorite.
Saying religious and insane is like saying jumbo shrimp.
I want to get into Dennis the Fox, Mother Trucker. And what I wanted to ask, though, is like, you know, at some point you had said like he was going to be the next Bowie. And through my own research, like the two people that are kind of outsiders that fit in that category are Jabriath and Smokey. Who apparently were both so just too gay for our culture at the time. So let's talk about Dennis the Fox and Mother Trucker. I want to get into the episodes we talked about. I love how you guys got into that, like each song was almost a different character.
Let's just talk
about, you know, I mean, I don't want you to repeat what you said in the episode, but I'm just curious on, you know, the oddity of this person. I'm looking for stories, I guess. I don't want to.
My favorite thing about it is that it's a bizarro universe. Sort of like a gutter rat retelling of Tony DeFries and the Main Man story with Bowie. I love that the whole thing is recorded in a shutdown menswear shop. instead of the, you know, highfalutin possibilities of a name like Ziggy Stardust, Dennis the Fox, which feels like a wet fart. I mean, there's
a kid show.
0% chance that name's going to take off. And all these things go to, you know, it's like you just can't make this shit up. But yet the music is still great, because one of the amazing things about Private Press is that instead of the usual construction of a record that's considered and, you know, has, you know, a certain style to it, the Private Press people are throwing everything at the wall, because they want you to know they can do this and this and that. So it's like organically psychedelic.
Yeah, certainly in Dennis the Fox's case and some other ones, Michael Farnetti as well, he's trying to have something to promote himself and show he has range. So he's thinking of that over, like, this is going to be a consistent ride on one, you know, magic carpet or something. It's like, yeah, he's trying to demonstrate his versatility.
And it's a wild ride because, you know, like, I think about Paul, you know, if you're sitting down and watching a movie and, you know, you feel like you're in the hands of somebody who maybe can't be trusted, like Toby Hooper in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know that this is effective, but you also get the feeling that, you know, this guy is not a Hitchcock. This guy is not like, you know, has a handle and a grip on his pacing. He's like on the roller coaster, hanging on for dear life along with you. And so, you know, that gives it like a precariousness you don't get with a commercially released record.
Yeah, you in that context, you start expecting the unexpected, and that's a really good place to be for me. Yeah.
That's the growing new ears that you talk about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to say one thing that really, you know, it's funny, like I listen to those episodes and I listen to Stonewall, and then you guys opened me up to this whole thing about the tax loss LPs, and I did 30 minutes on that. I envisioned an entire movie about what's his name, about Mark Twain. I looked up him, and then you know, when I listened to the episode on the Kaplan Brothers, by the time I was done that interview, I had bought their album. I had emailed one of the brothers to interview. Because the stories that you, what I love about that, you guys dig into the stuff around it, and then you present that. That's really when I, like, you know, I knew I had to join I knew I wanted to hear about all this stuff, but because I hadn't really had a lot of time, I didn't get it. But after this episode, I'm like a super fan. I mean, I already was, but I get that what's interesting about what you're doing. It's not only like, you know, you're being outsiders in your own way of the way you're presenting it. You're like, okay, well, check this thing out. And this guy was the manager and he did this weird shit. And I appreciate you guys' honesty and realness in it. It blew me away. And I mean, literally, not many things you listen to make you buy something and email somebody within 20 minutes in your podcast.
And that's awesome. And that,
I can imagine it happening to a lot more episodes.
That's so cool. I mean, I know Paul feels it too. It's like that It's a Wonderful Life thing. It's like, you know, we do this thing and send it out into the world. And now the Kaplan brothers are going to get, you know, a more increased, more intense spotlight shined down on them. That's the reward.
It reminds me of something somebody said when I told him, you're really going to like this. It was a guy in Germany way, way back, one of the first times I had a spare Peter Grigsian album and sent it to him, thinking, you're the person that's, I think, from what you bought before, are going to be receptive to this. Because most people early on, I was trying to turn on to Peter Grigsian. Just, it was a point and laugh thing or whatever. And the guy wrote back to me, a letter comes, this is not a record. This is life itself.
Wow. That seems, I mean, and from what I've read about the stuff you put out in this world, that seems like that's like one of the holy grails in this world.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For me.
I'm curious in yours as well. What are you guys holy grails that you found, and what are your holy grails that you just keep looking for?
Are you guys still looking for records? You guys still go out, hit the local thrifts?
Not so much anymore. Yeah, when I got involved with the band and all this kind of stuff, and I started my own label, Parallel World, back in the 90s, I got so divorced from this just when the internet was going that I kept going everywhere. And when the tours would happen, of course, anytime I could get to the local used record shop, I'd get there. And early on, when the internet was going, it would still be, okay, you're not going to find some obvious psychedelic garage punk 60s album anymore. They're hip to that, but you might find one of these real people weirdos. They're not hip to that yet. And I noticed as the tours went on, it became like, no, I better sleep in the hotel because I'm going to go in that store and everything they're going to look up on and anything that they don't know what it is that they would think nobody knows what this is. So it's a dollar. Who would want this? It's the opposite. Anything they didn't know what it was, even if it was a spoken word record or something, one comes to mind in New York later on, I would find even those now, then they were afraid to let go of it, you know, anymore. They stopped putting anything that they didn't know was worthless in the dollar bins. They were afraid to make a mistake because people like me would come in and you know, I'd find this is a local record. Say, you have any more of these in the back or whatever? And they, you know, in the old days, it'd be like, oh, good, this sucker's going to buy all the copies we have of this. And it became the other way around. As soon as that question came across, it became like, uh-oh. And then I'm sure when the internet got going, a lot of these local guys in stores looked up and found out, oh, that local record that was sitting in our store for $10, you know, to start and went down to 50 cents and still nobody bought it. $2,000. Who's the sucker? You know.
And a better question is, if I was making a biopic of your lives, all of you, the three of you, what would be that moment where you found this one record and it just like that would tell the audience that this is a fucking, this was a mind blowing, and whether that's maybe after playing it, I mean, what was, oh shit, what's that one? Okay, there you go. You are a Beast Boy. Okay, there you go.
that's I think the greatest work of art. In any medium that's ever been created.
I hear you. Smile. It seems like, Paul, you have probably 30 of them.
There are lots. There are moments. Certainly the one that changed my life was the Kenneth Higney, 1977. I brought my punk rock band after being in L.A. a little too early. We decided we should have come to New York, came to New York, and we had a free house to live in New Jersey. And there was a local newspaper called The Aquarian that was like the entertainment paper, you know, shows or whatever going on type thing. And one day at this house, a box arrives with three copies because we had a recording studio in the basement. So we were saying, you know, use our recording studio. A box comes, three copies of Kenneth Higney. Of course, I didn't know what it was. Open it up. I thought it was one of the most amazing things I ever heard. Everything's so wrong. My friends couldn't stop listening to it, even though he thought it was the like worst thing to say. We got to listen to that Higney again and so forth. So that was a revelation moment that just by chance those dropped in my mailbox. It wasn't even a record store. The dude sent me, you know, the three copies of the record and said, oh, I don't need to record, you know, these are demos of my songs. Can you, you know, do you have any suggestions like how I can break into country music, you know? And
why did he send them to you, Paul?
To the house, because we had an ad in a local music paper, and there was a band in New York called the Sick Fucks that were popular CBGB that came from St. Louis, where I came from, and we were like the local first punk bands there. And they had a different name, but they came to New York and said, oh, guys, you know, you went to L.A., come to New York, you got a free house you can live in, you know, till you find a place in the city. So it was because of this ad advertising that we had a recording studio that he sent the records, not to record, but just saying, can you help me with my music career? So that was a revelation. You know, when I looked at those, you know, and looked at the picture and everything, I just thought, I got to know what this guy's like. I got to get inside of his head even more than the record is getting me inside his head, you know. But one of the all-time ones was Peter Grizzian, and that was early on in Manhattan. And I was coming back from the Salvation Army headquarters because I would go there. Actually, I would get up early. That was the only thing that would get me up early. or I'd stay up if I was out all night at Max's or whatever. And I would go there like before it opened because you hit it the right day, like which I did sometimes. One time a guy worked at Columbia, obviously Epic, had dumped his stuff. So there were like CAC, just all these incredible, like 100 incredible Millennium, all these records there and so forth. So I would go there to buy the records. And on the way back, there was a weird junk shop I was walking. I never saw before. It just looked like a curiosity shop that a hurricane had hit. And there were some albums on the floor against the wall. And I'm flipping through. I look at the Peter Grizzian. I'm walking and I have my bag. I've got enough records. I can't carry anymore. Time to go back to the apartment. I come back And I saw that. It's the first one I'm going to play. And on the way back, I popped a 40 and got a little buzz on. Walking back, I put it on the turntable. And as soon as those first piano notes come across, it felt like I had been abducted by some aliens from another dimension. It just was the most astonishing moment. And it just got better and better. So there are a lot of stories like that. Where the album came to me, I knew nothing about it. It looked like this can't go wrong. And when I heard it, it was 100 times even better than I imagined it could possibly be.
Do you have one, Tony? I do, but I just wanted to ask Paul real quickly. But you always come back to the people and, you know, just calling it real world. I mean, real people music. I mean, it almost seems like you're more interested in the people than the music sometimes. And I don't want to put one above the other, but.
I think they're inseparable to me. And I've had art, what is art arguments with very intellectual people about art. And they always tell me, I don't even understand what they're saying, but they always say, you're trying to redefine what art is. You know, sometimes, what do you mean? Or something. And it has to do with my obsession. Like the most important thing to me is the person's life that's here. And this is document, a window into their existence. And
I think you've become, Paul, a very sensitive to top, you know, commercial artists obfuscating who they are with their music, whereas you've become attuned and empathetic to music that is a window into somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a way to put it. It's a window into life. And, you know, I always have the thought, you know, it only exists in our mind anyways, music, you know, otherwise it's invisible sound waves and that. So I just have this, like, it doesn't even exist if somebody's not hearing it, you know.
I want to share, if it's okay with you guys, my holy grail, which I haven't found yet, it's the Valley Girl soundtrack. That movie, I'm obsessed with.
Dude, the opening song is so great. It's Girls Like Me, right?
Yeah. Apparently they put it on an album, apparently, and then there was some issue, legal issue, and they took it away. And so I could never find it. I wound up buying all the albums and then making a tape in 1986 or something. And then I was watching Night of the Comet. And during Night of the Comet...
Which is Valley Girls with Aliens.
Which is Valley Girls with Aliens.
Yeah.
And the movie theater they're stuck in is showing Valley Girl and has one or two albums. And I'm like, it exists. And I've been looking for it. The only thing you could find is a reissue for $150. I'm not spending I might spend $200 on the original or $300, but not on the reissue. It's just not for me. Anyway, that's mine. Do you have one?
There's too many records I'm looking for.
But I want to basically end this. I need to dig in more into the Kappen Brothers. And it's funny, when I first read about them and heard you talk about them, they reminded me of a band which is similar, that did Messianic Jewish music, otherwise known as Jews for Jesus, called Lamb. Have you ever come across Lamb?
Too much.
Yeah, they had several albums, as I recall. And I've had.
Reminded me a lot.
I don't remember them as being particularly interesting musically.
No, but they what they did, their covers were cool. Their covers were like, one is like a copy of, like, they would reference prog rock, and their covers were cool.
Oh yeah, I made many mistakes early on buying Lamb records because the covers look cool.
The main question I have for you guys in terms of the Kappen Brothers is, how are they, the two of them are actual real brothers, right?
Right.
How the fuck aren't they, how the fuck is one of them Jewish and one's not? Did you get to?
I don't want to know, because I need the mystery of that to be retained.
What is it about that album particularly? I mean, you know, one thing is I want to recommend people is joining the Patreon, getting access to this stuff. I talk to my listeners. I never do. I never think anyone else is here. But listeners, please join. This Patreon is amazing. This show is amazing. What they're doing is amazing. Obviously, hopefully you get that from this conversation. But particularly, $20 a month just for that episode alone is worth it.
It's the major tier. It's all structured like the
Kiss major Army. Tier. Okay.
It's structured after the Kiss Army. And so think Paul Major, the major tier.
Okay.
The major tier, you get three shows a week. You get the free show on Friday. And by the way, now it's all structured like a thematically, intrinsically interwoven deep dive. So, for example, on March 31st. You get part one of a two-parter of a great interview with Sergio Diaz from Os Mutantes. Then on Monday, there is a separate show that I do about all their records. Then on Wednesday, there's a South American private press. So the whole thing, we're doing a one-week deep dive. Every Friday, it resets to another deep dive. So the only way to get what I consider to be the true three-dimensionality of the program, and which, by the way, we're working nonstop to make it happen. It's not like we do the show and then that's it. You would have to get all three shows to be able to experience that.
And we do our own deep dives. We have a page. I'm going to give you guys access to our Patreon just for the code, because we give it to our guests because of what you guys are doing. And I did one on private press stuff, and it had your stuff, but I actually added the podcast to that. And it's the same kind of thing. It's just like going in different directions. What's interesting, I love that kind of stuff. And it was such a pleasure, Paul and David, just meeting both of you. Like, been a big fan of yours, Paul, for years. David, you are now in the same kind of fanship because of what you're doing.
One thing that Paul and I want to express with 100%, full disclosure, is that we believe so strongly in what we're doing being a mission that's needed, that if you have a membership for a month and you really actually don't see the value of it or don't understand what we're going on about, immediate refund. I will refund you immediately. Just give it a shot. If you're a music fan, the one thing that I can say that'll be like, okay, instant value, is that every week you're going to get music recommendations of shit that you've not heard of. And if you have come to the logical conclusion of knowing every Bob Neal, Joni, Pavement, all the big bands, if you know them all and you don't know where to go next, it's discography time.
Can you talk a little bit before we end, since we focus so much on the deep dives and the private press stuff, what are some things, can you give a picture of the other stuff that you really get into?
Yeah, I mean, I just finished a 13-hour interview with the two founding members of the association. I just finished an 8-hour interview with David Pajo, which is going to be one episode. He was in Slint. He was in Zwan. He was a member of Interpol, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Stereolab. Immensely talented guy. His own solo career is under Papa M or Ariel M. I'm about to do a huge discographical trawl with the great Vashti Bunyan.
Oh, I saw that. I was very excited about that one.
That's yeah, really cool. She's going to rate every single thing she's ever done along with me. And Joel Selvin, who's writing a biography on Jim Gordon, just committed to doing a Jim Gordon episode, which I'm thrilled about. So this is the kind of shit. I mean, I don't look for exactly this and then this. So I don't necessarily, it's not necessarily about finding a record. It's about like finding an artist whose life and work I can completely and utterly consume. And then book what to them they think is going to be a 1-hour interview. And it takes most of their life until I'm done.
I want you to mention the plan for the TV show while we're here, just so people can get excited about what that's going to look like.
So it's called Discographies, the Private Press with Paul Major, just like the show. And it's structured like the show Catfish, except instead of Max and Neve, it's two much more handsome people who are showing up at old style psychedelic guru and real people's doorsteps, and trying to see what they've been contending with, what their life is like. I think from a human interest angle, I'm even more excited than I am musically, because to get a sense of who these people have become as a result of their work not being successful could be a good thing. It could be the worst thing that ever happened. And I'm just dying to find out. And I think that, the music heads will get the value of new recommendations all the time. And the people who don't care about music, you can't not, you know, empathize with life throwing you curveballs. We're actually going to be creating new tiers for the Patreon, which, by the way, it's at patreon.com/discograffiti. And we're going to be creating new tiers that Paul and I are very excited about. Once we figure out the guest for the very first pilot episode, we're going to allow people to come on board through a subscription to be actually involved as producers and executive producers.
All right, guys. Great, great getting to know you guys. Paul, David, such a pleasure, man. Thank you so
absolutely
much
for your time. A pleasure for me, too. Totally, man.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Great day. Thanks again for your time.
No problem. Thank
right
you.
On.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for checking out the podcast this week. We got one more to do for the year, and then we're starting season two. So this is exciting. For those that don't know, we are doing a tribute to Paul Rubens. It's possibly going to be a live Zoom kind of thing, or it might just be a podcast episode. We're still figuring that out, but it will be happening. And also, we always celebrate Jim Henson's birthday on September 24th. That's also essentially our 1 year anniversary. So we're going to be doing some special things. So again, please help out, support, share the word on what we're doing. We have the Instagram, Vintage Annals Archive. We have our website, vintageannalsarchive.com. On that has a bunch of stuff. We've got all these deep dives about 50, which, you know, we have one on private press music, which we talk about today. I've got one on Paul Williams, Paul Rubens, all kinds of stuff. They're all, you know, essentially it's set up as all these resources for you to kind of deep dive on your own. I've made my own playlists in terms of its music. I've made my own video playlists. A lot of work has gone into those, all essentially voluntary. And then we have a really nice video archive of stuff that I've collected, you know, and stuff that I've just, you know, some favorites of mine growing up, some really good stuff. You can spend hours on there watching different things. We have a photo archive of found collections, some of my family, some all kinds of really cool stuff. And that's like that's my physical archive as that, you know, archived online, and you could use those images for different things. We have a Jewish Venezuelans archive, a separate thing that I've started doing a few months ago when I realized anti-Semitism was just horrible and I wanted to do something about it. So we have a lot of stuff. We have a page we do for Arlene Gottfried. If you go to Arlene Gottfried Legacy Project, it's an Instagram. We have a Philadelphia-based podcast. We're working on a photography one. There's a lot going on. I'm really, you know, very excited. I gotta always plug my friend and coworker, we'll say. I mean, he gets a few bucks here and there. Otter Castro is a dream person to find. He's the only person I know who's listened to all the episodes and also just knows everything. You know, I'll find some obscure guests, like, oh, I interviewed them. Oh, I know them. And I'm like, holy shit. So, like, he is a godsend, and he really works hard on not a lot of money doing all the editing and researching and producing some episodes. We discussed a lot about, like, you know, kind of focuses a take, and he's just really great. And he produces also in terms of the editing, he's producing kind of what exists, and I fully trust him. So yeah, that's it. Anyway, just, you know, check it out. We're in a great place. Our Instagram is about to hit 42,000 followers, which is really nice. It's no joke. Instagram is not made to get followers without paying for it. And if we don't have a ton of money, we've gotten very lucky. So yeah. So please, you know, please keep updated. We're very excited about season two, more, just an amazing lineup. We're still behind on some episodes, so there's a bunch more coming out. So very excited to be doing this. This is an honor for me. Thank you again for your support and for listening.
We thought in different ways. Look around the world today. Richie, I